At that time, I was going to try to fly all the airplanes that our Air Force had. But I realized if I was going to be successful at attaining that goal, that really I should become a test pilot. I was always asking the Air Force to send me to test pilot school. Well, finally, after 10 years, they just tired of processing all the paperwork. And they said, "All right, Captain, we're going to send you out to Edwards Air Force Base and let you learn how to become a test pilot." Well, this was a great day in my life. It seemed to be the answer to prayer. I reported into Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert, and I learned all the things that a test pilot must know, and it took about a year. I graduated, and then I had the greatest of all opportunities, and that was to be assigned as the first and only test pilot in the world's highest and fastest flying airplane, the YF-12A. The plane that was to set the speed and altitude record for our country just a few years later. And so consequently, I was a very proud young man, a proud pilot. I'm sure I had a big head. I'm surprised that I was even able to put my helmet on, because for me it was a mountaintop experience. I was on cloud nine. I should have known that I was in for a letdown, but little did I realize just how abrupt that letdown would be. Because one morning, in fact, a Sunday morning, I was out flying with a student, a little light airplane, and we crashed. I want all of you to realize that the student was at the controls as we took off that morning. But just after takeoff, we were turning on a crosswind when the plane went into an uncontrollable flat spin, one from which we could not recover, and we just plunged into the desert. Well, fortunately, when the plane struck the earth, it did not catch on fire. And they were able to get in there and drag our bodies out and fly us to another base that could properly treat us. Because we were both severely injured. For me, it meant two broken legs, a broken jaw, concussion, many cuts and bruises, amnesia for 24 hours, a right leg so badly shattered that they actually considered amputating my foot. Well, I think you can well imagine the thoughts that raced through my mind when I awakened, found myself in the hospital, flat on my back, tied to the bed, all those needles sticking in me, and just wondering, could this really have happened to Jim Irwin, the hottest pilot in the sky? Well, very quickly I realized it had happened to me, and it was a very humbling feeling to bite the dust in such an inglorious way. My next thought was just a question, and I just asked, God, why? God, why have you allowed this to happen to me? You'd raised me up so high, and here you've let me fall so low. Why, God? Why let this happen to Jim Irwin? What are you trying to tell me? As I lay there in that hospital bed, I began to pray, and I prayed to God harder than I ever had before, praying for understanding and for recovery. God answered those prayers. I quickly realized I'd been rushing through life too fast, not fully appreciating the daily blessings of life. God also answered my prayers for recovery, because in just 2 short months I was able to hobble out of the hospital. Yes, I hobbled out because both my legs were still in casts, almost up to the hip. My jaw still wired together, and I was on crutches as I made my way out of the hospital. But as many of you know, that's a very important step, to be able to leave the hospital under your own power. 2 more months went by, and my wounds had healed completely to the point where I knew I was ready to fly again. But then I was in for even a greater disappointment, because the Air Force said, "No, Captain, we're sorry. You're a pilot. You've had a very serious accident. We can't possibly allow you to fly for at least a year while we completely evaluate you." This was so difficult to accept, to know that I was ready to go back into the sky and to be held down. Required a lot more prayer for understanding. But finally, after 14 months, those prayers were answered. Once again, I was restored to flying status and once again able to soar through the sky. Oh, I've always loved the high places because, frankly, I've always felt closer to God when on the high places of the earth or in the sky. Once I was back to flying status, I rejoined my test project. Quite disappointed, though, to find that there were several other pilots serving on that staff. And so I had to go back down to the bottom of the ladder. I had to go back down to the bottom of the ladder and begin climbing my way up all over again. Well, I was able to work up to the point of flying that very fast airplane. But then it became obvious that man could go even higher, that man could actually go out into space. Oh, the Russians had sent one of their cosmonauts. Our country was making preparations to send an American. So naturally, I wanted to try my hand at that, trying again to go a little higher, a little faster. But believe me, it wasn't an easy task to convince the space program that Jim Irwin should become an astronaut. I tried for many years, several applications. Oh, I just about despaired of ever being selected. I'd left the test pilot business, I had a desk job, and I was right at the age limit when I put in that last application. But I made it in 1966. I was finally selected as one of the U.S. astronauts. Reported to Houston, Texas to begin that last portion of our training. Final preparation for a trip into space. A new lifestyle. Many new subjects to learn. A spacecraft that flies a little bit differently than an aircraft. And in a suit much different than any flying suit that we'd ever had on before. And I can recall so well that stifling feeling of claustrophobia that just about gripped me when they first locked me in that suit, and I wondered, how can I possibly live and work in the suit for days at a time? But gradually they just increased that exposure to that suit until gradually we just accepted it as another suit of clothes. Well, it takes a number of years to get a man ready to go out into space, ready to anticipate the many things that might happen. And in my case, it took 5 years for that preparation. As I look back on that period of time now, I really view it as a preparation in three very distinct areas, and that's the preparation of body, mind, and spirit. And my daily prayer was that God would guide me in those preparations for flight. God answered those prayers because in the summer of 1971, we were considered ready for our flight to the moon. Yes, July 26, 1971, a day I'll never forget, a day that began very early, because at 4:30 that morning, Deke Slayton, our boss, came into our little bedrooms, and he aroused us, and his first words were, "Okay, guys, you ready to go to the moon today?" We groggily said we were. Then they took us into the mess hall where they fed us a big breakfast because they wanted us to be well-nourished for that flight to the moon. After breakfast, they took us into the suit room where they stuffed us into the spacesuit. Not that we'd eaten that much for breakfast, but those suits are just a very tight fit. Once they get us into the suit, they put the gloves on for us, they slip the helmet over our head and lock it into position, and they begin testing the suit to make sure it's absolutely airtight, because we'll be dependent upon the security of that suit for many, many hours once we get out in space. Once everyone was assured that we had three very airtight suits, they took us from that room down in the elevator, placed us in the mobile van, and we began the slow drive out to the launch pad. As we drove out in the van, we could look out the windows and see that it was a beautiful morning. The sun was up. There were no clouds in the sky that might hinder our launch. It was just a joy to be alive. But for some reason, there wasn't much conversation as we drove out. Oh, I looked into the faces of my colleagues and we smiled at each other. But we didn't talk very much as we drove out because there were so many thoughts racing through our minds as we drove out to that rendezvous with destiny. Once we get out to the launch pad, we get out of the van. We had a brief opportunity then to look up and see the tower, the booster, and to see the spacecraft way, way up on top. And what a beautiful sight it was, just gleaming white in that early morning light. You could see the vapors issuing forth from that giant rocket. You could tell that the rocket was just poised for flight, just held down to the earth by that giant's grasp. But just that very brief opportunity, because then they took us over to the tower, placed us in the elevator, then took us all the way to the top, about 360 feet high. And then they led us quickly across the swing arm, that narrow walkway that leads from the tower over to the spacecraft. And then into the white room, that enclosure that surrounds the command module. And then they began the operation referred to as crew insertion, And that's just precisely what it is. They're inserting the crew into the spacecraft. A delicate operation, one in which we need a great deal of assistance because we're so bulky and clumsy in those big spacesuits. And so we have a team of men, several on the outside, but two on the inside that guide our bodies as we slide into the couch. They're very careful that we don't hit any switch or circuit breaker because that could be disastrous. Once they get us into the proper position in the couch, they attach the umbilicals to the suit, which brings in the oxygen that we need for life. Then they attach the seat belt with the shoulder harness, and they pull it down very tightly, very securely, because they want us absolutely anchored to the couch for the accelerations of liftoff. Once our helpers got the three of us tied down very securely, they patted us on the shoulder, and then they got out. Then they closed that big steel hatch and went clang like a dungeon door. And we realized at that moment that these guys were no longer fooling around. This was no longer a practice, a dry run, or simulation. This was it. This was a moment of truth. They were really sending us to the moon. And with that realization, believe me, it hits you right down in the pit of the stomach. But unfortunately, they don't just launch you right away. They don't just close the door and press a button and off you go. No, they make you lie there for several hours, waiting and wondering. I frequently get the question, Jim or Colonel Irwin, were you ever scared on that flight to the moon? And I always say, no, astronauts are never scared. But sometimes we're a little tense. And that was one of those periods of time. And I think you can understand why, because we're lying in there without much to do. We're listening to the countdown. We're watching the instruments to make sure that everything's functioning properly in that giant rocket. And so time goes by too slowly. There's this air of anticipation, this air of expectancy as the hours drag by. But then that last minute goes extremely fast. Before you know it, you hear the word ignition. And then you sense, and then you feel, and then you hear all that tremendous power that's being released underneath that rocket. It's beginning to lift you off the earth. And there's a moment there just of supreme elation, complete release of tensions, almost the happiest moment of my life, to realize that after all of these years of training and preparation, at last it's my turn. At last I'm leaving the earth. We hold our breath for a few more seconds until we hear the words tower clear, because at that point we knew that we were off the earth. Clear the tower, and on a clear and purposeful voyage to the moon. A voyage in which we might encounter problems, but a flight in which we knew we were trained. We had equipment we had confidence in. We knew that we had the best brains available all over the earth to help us if a problem should arise. But most importantly, we knew that we had the prayers of men and women, boys and girls, all over the earth. And with a send-off like that, you can't help but have just the greatest flight out of this world. Well, we did have a beautiful flight. We saw things that we'll never see again in our mortal lives. By far the most beautiful thing that we saw was the earth, when we could see it as just a ball in the sky. This opportunity occurred about 4 hours after we made the burn over the Pacific that put us on that trajectory out to the moon. We were out about 50,000 miles when we maneuvered the spacecraft to look at the Earth. And as we maneuvered the spacecraft, the Earth just silently and majestically drifted right into the center of my window. And I looked out and I just couldn't believe my eyes because it was such a magnificent sight. I called to my colleagues, Dave and Al, and I said, guys, come over here and look at this. And very quickly, the two of them floated over to the window, and all of a sudden we had three heads, six eyeballs, glued to the window, looking out at the spacecraft Earth. There it was in all of its beauty. It was a full Earth, fully illuminated, very few clouds, so we could clearly see the continents of the Earth. We could see the warm natural colors, the tans of the deserts and the mountains, the blues and greens of the great oceans of the Earth, and in the whites of a few clouds that were on the earth that day. And as we looked at the earth from that vantage point, we're reminded of a Christmas tree ornament hanging there in the blackness of space. But it seemed like the most fragile, the most delicate Christmas tree ornament you could ever imagine. It looked as if we could touch it with our finger, that the whole thing would just crumble and fall apart. But the thing that touched me very deeply was to see the earth begin to shrink in size, diminish as we got farther and farther away, to see it shrink from the size of a basketball down to the size of a baseball, to the size of a golf ball, and then finally just to the size of a marble. And to look back and realize that everything that we ever cared about, everything that we ever loved, was out there on that little marble. And believe me, that does something to you inside. Brings a man back profoundly changed. To look back and see the earth with the eyes of God. Yes, it changed my life. Brought me back with just the deepest appreciation for the earth and everything that we have on it. But also made me keenly aware, for really the first time in my life, about the creation of God. The control that God exerts over the total universe, and in the closeness that He provides, that as we travel into the blackness, that as we travel into the black recesses of space, that He goes along with us, and indeed it seems like He's there ahead of us to prepare our way. And that was so true when we came in for landing, to land on the moon. To land in that beautiful little valley called Hadley Base. Beautiful because we had the towering Apennine Mountains on three sides of us. A deep canyon to the west. The mountains towered some 15,000 feet above our campsite. And they were golden brown in that early morning sun. And we had an early morning sun condition the 3 days we were on the surface. And so we were surrounded by this desert-like beauty. But the thing that really touched my soul and changed the course of my life was feeling that God was there in a very personal way. Yes, He was there to answer prayer, because I did pray. We encountered difficult situations, things that we'd never anticipated in all those years of training. And when these very difficult situations came up, I just gave a quick silent prayer to God, and just immediately the answer came back. It was just instant communication. And then it was the guidance that He gave to us as we explored the surface, looking for a light-colored rock, possibly a white rock, because the scientists had told us to look for such a rock because it would represent the mountains of the moon and hence the oldest material found on the moon. But we never dreamed that we'd find it quite so easily, because most of the rocks on the moon are covered with dust. But that wasn't so of the white rock or the Genesis rock. No, there at the base of one of those towering Apennine Mountains, on the rim of a small crater, and then on a pedestal rock that looked much like an outstretched palm, there sat the white Genesis rock, almost free from dust, atop that dust-covered pedestal, lifted up so we could see it long before we got over there, realizing that was the rock that would come all the way to the moon to find. It seemed to be saying, "Here am I. Take me." And then there was the inspiration of God's presence that caused me to try to quote Scripture. And I tried to quote that first verse from Psalm 121. "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help." Oh, I added that we do get a little help from Houston, because I was afraid Mission Control might turn off our radio communications. Oh, I was proud to be there on the moon. Proud again that I'm an American. Proud of the accomplishments that our country has performed. We enjoyed those 3 days on the moon. In fact, when it became time to leave, there were mixed emotions. We would have liked to have stayed and completed our exploration, but we knew that we must leave. Our water was completely gone and our oxygen almost completely exhausted. And so we left with mixed emotions. And as the rocket engine fired, we were relieved. We were surprised that we were lifting off to the accompaniment of the Air Force song. But that's a great way to leave the moon. We pitched over in a lunar module and we were looking straight down. We could see the descent stage, the tracks that we made, the scientific base, as we lifted off, leaving a place that we would never visit again. And so there was this feeling of nostalgia. We spent a few extra days circling the moon. We made the burn that would put us on a trajectory to return us to the Earth. We came around the backside of the moon, and we watched as the moon began to become smaller, and we knew that our trip home had begun. By this time, we had adjusted very well to the feeling of weightlessness. We knew where everything was, and we knew that after we used things, we must put them back. And so we'd adapted quite well to life in space. And it would have been nice to have stayed up for at least another week, but that was impossible. We were on a return trajectory to meet with the Earth. We were also thinking about home, our loved ones, and the things that we would be able to do on the Earth that we could never do in space. And so again, we had mixed emotions. Then there was the sudden onset of acceleration, re-entry, a physical endurance to suddenly feel the human body weigh 7 times as much as it normally would. Held captive in the couch. No possibility to reach a cert. No possibility to reach a switch or a circuit breaker. That searing, blazing heat of reentry, lasting 4 minutes. And when communications are restored again, it's time for the drogue chute and then the main chutes to come out. Then it was that heart-stopping moment to look up and see that one of the main chutes had failed. Here we were coming down on 2 chutes and a prayer. It seemed like God was hastening our return to the earth. For what? We did not realize at that time. Yes, God did have a new plan for my life. The trip to the moon was over, but my greatest mission was just beginning. It was to share the old story from a space perspective. God is alive. God answers prayer throughout the universe. And God loves all of us so much that He sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to the spacecraft Earth to give us all purpose and fulfillment. I want to share the motto of Apollo 15, words that we saw, words that meant so much to us that we carried them to the moon and we returned them to the Earth. Man's flight through life is sustained by the power of His knowledge, underlining His and capitalizing His, because it is not the knowledge of the mind, but the knowledge of Christ in the heart that will give man the strength to travel through the valleys of life, and then give him the power to make the ultimate space trip, to leave the earth, to be with God forever. Yes, God did have a new plan for my life. The trip to the moon was over, but my greatest mission was just beginning. It was to share the old story from a space perspective. God is alive. God answers prayer throughout the universe. And God loves all of us so much that He sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to the spacecraft Earth to give us all purpose and fulfillment. As I stood on the hangar deck of the Okinawa, ready to make my little speech, I was almost overwhelmed with pride that America had done it again. America has sent 12 men to the surface of the moon to place 6 American flags. We are indebted to those founding fathers who had the dedication and vision to establish a country where a man could reach for the stars and accomplish the seemingly impossible task of reaching the moon. They would be very proud knowing that 6 American flags are on another heavenly body where 1,000 years is but as a day. These men were willing to sacrifice their sacred honor, their fortunes, and even gave their lives for this free land. Can we do any less and still expect our nation to enjoy another century of freedom?